By invitation of the management, 183 years ago, a select group gathered at the pit head of a coal mine in the Midlands of England. There was to be a demonstration of a strange new device which probably made a noise something like this. The group was impressed. On March 11th, 1776, the Birmingham Gazette carried the following item.
On Friday last, a steam engine,
capital S, capital E,
constructed upon Mr. Watt's new principles,
capital P,
was set to work at Bloomfield Colliery in the presence of a number of scientific gentlemen, whose curiosity,
capital C,
was excited to see the first movements of so singular and powerful a machine.
Capital P, capital M.
By this example, the doubts of the inexperienced were dispelled.
Doubts were dispelled. And so, as it turned out, was a way of life.
United Nations Radio presents In Tempests of Motion, a program concerning social justice and commemorating the 40th anniversary of an agency dedicated to it, the International Labor Organization. Our narrator is Joseph Cotton. This is a story set in Tempests of Motion.
A few odd words chosen deliberately from a great dramatic poem. Changes of life, limitless ocean, over and under, seething strife, birth and grave, and two complete lines as follows.
In currents of life, in tempests of motion, in fervor of act, in the fire, in the storm.
Lines from the drama of Faust, written by Johann Wolfgang von Goethe between the years 1770 and 1832. In their precise context, they have a metaphysical quality, but we've quoted them here in their literal sense, and Goethe, we feel, would not object. As well as being a poet, he was a man of science. Indeed, he himself considered a book in which he developed a theory of the quality of light as his greatest work. So, it's not assuming too much to suggest that the literal currents of life and tempests of motion at the time influenced him profoundly. Goethe was in at the beginning of a revolution which hasn't ended yet. The political currents, the emergence of an independent United States of America, the violent change from monarchy to republic in France, the rise and fall of Napoleon, and all the other fervor-filled acts of the 19th century were part of it. But looking back, we can see that the social currents in the long run were more significant. The demonstration at Bloomfield Colliery was but a clumsy trigger starting the mechanical tempest in motion. Railways, steamships, dark satanic mills, the splendor of wealth and the squalor of poverty. The evils of the Industrial Revolution in human terms are too well known to need much emphasis here. There used to be an old music hall song in England which sums them up rather nicely. The band in the pit would bump out an introduction, the curtain would rise, and there, in comic hat and baggy pants, would be the funny man.
Evening, one and all. For your pleasure, a little song entitled, Don't Go Down the Mine, Daddy, Let Mother Go Down Instead.
Meanwhile, back at the coal fields, the chances were that not only Daddy, but Mother and children as well were down the mine, hacking and coughing for next to nothing, or spending 16 profitless hours a day in a dingy, stinking factory tending the looms. Any twinges of conscience? Any voices of protest? Anyone for reform?
Robert Owen, the cotton manufacturer? And Charles Hindley, the Member of Parliament.
In England?
Louis Villerme, the surgeon. And Émile de Girardin, the newspaper editor.
In France.
Daniel Maresca, the professor of chemistry.
In Belgium.
Le Grand.
Marx.
Hahn.
Dupetiot.
Blanqui.
Tolstoy.
Audigan.
These men and others, in their various ways and at various times and places, sought to humanize the appalling conditions. But they were individual reformers facing the odds all men of vision have always had to face. Governments, authorities in those days tended to be either unsympathetic, disinterested, or even vindictive.
The constable will read the charge.
The six defendants, being by occupation laborers of Tudpuddle in the county of Dorsetshire, are hereby charged with having, by combination, tried to obtain an increase of their wages and with having taken an oath to their trade union.
So much for any grassroots movement toward reform. The verdict?
Guilty.
And the sentence?
Transportation to the colonies in Australia for a period of 7 years.
Transported they were, for Australia in 1834 was a conveniently distant depository for what authorities in England sometimes blithely called the redundant poor. Or possibly in the case of the Tudpuddle martyrs, as they came to be known, the recalcitrant riffraff. The fact is, during the political and social tempests and changes of the 19th century, the conscience of officialdom was slow to respond to the pricks and prods of enlightened individuals and associations. There was evidence of progress, of course, plenty of it. In some quarters, even the idea that what is good for the worker is good for business began to take root. But the long perspective shows that it wasn't really until 1945, and on June 26th that year, the ideal of social justice was clearly stated in a genuinely universal and formally binding document, the Charter of the United Nations.
Chapter 1, Purposes and Principles. Article 1, Paragraph 3. The purposes of the United Nations are to achieve international cooperation in solving international problems of an economic, social, cultural, or humanitarian character, and in promoting and encouraging respect for human rights and for fundamental freedoms for all without distinction.
That covers a lot of ground. The drafters of the Charter had 360-degree vision. Events had persuaded them that while the microscopic approach has its value, it wasn't much use concentrating on the particular if the general is sneaking up on you from all angles, screaming for action and attention. Hence the post-war upsurge of international agencies, organs, commissions, committees, the United Nations family, with their panoramic and interlocking responsibilities and operations, all aimed at the ultimate worldwide interlocking of the dividends of human ingenuity with the recognition of human dignity. If we had the time and you the patience, we could describe the work of all these organizations and their relationships to the whole. But the prime purpose of this program is to honor just one of them, now in its 40th year in the service of peace, the International Labor Organization.
Whereas peace can be established only if it is based upon social justice, and whereas conditions of labor exist which involve injustice, hardship, and privation to large numbers of people.
The beginning of Part 13 of the Treaty of Versailles, which became the Constitution of the ILO.
Labor is not a commodity or an article of commerce.
Basic principle number one in that constitution. And today?
We find now that labor policy in most countries no longer primarily is a problem of protection of workers as it was when the ILO was founded in 1919.
This is Mr. David A. Morse, Director General of the ILO since 1948.
Labor policy is now an integral part of national economic and social policy. The institutions dealing with social and labor questions are growing rapidly in size and number.
A measure of growth, of change, reflected in, and in many cases inspired by, the work of the ILO. Even as recently as 1919, as those quotes from the Constitution indicate, the social climate of the 19th century still more or less prevailed. Otherwise, it would hardly have been necessary to express such thoughts. And if we retrace a few more steps, the need for the organization comes into even sharper focus. 1916, on the Western Front, deadlock in the trenches, blood at Verdun and on the Somme. On the Eastern Front, slow, exhausting decline of the Imperial Russian Army. On the home fronts, on both sides, a growing sense of determination that what had been must never be again. The social discontent of a century was finding articulate expression.
Dear Mr. Prime Minister.
Just one expression among many. A letter dated August 1916 from Mr. William A. Appleton, Secretary of the General Federation of Trade Unions in Britain, to the Prime Minister, Mr. Herbert Asquith. The last paragraph.
Nearly all other wars have ended with treaties which conserved the rights of kings, the boundaries of nations, and the privileges of property. The poor people have had no part in the making of war or peace. They have suffered, they have endured, and they have died. But never yet has monarch or statesman made their situation a determining factor in a treaty of peace. The time has arrived for better methods, for the consideration of the common rather than the particular interest, for the wide conception of human rights rather than the narrow one.
Well, the war ended. The time arrived. The time to consider the common interest, to eliminate the lingering social evils. The ILO was and is uniquely composed and qualified for its job. On its councils, the representatives of workers, employers, and governments sit in partnership. From the very beginning, they began to build a world labor code, the technique, international instruments, conventions, which member governments were free to accept or reject. They covered many things. On land, in industry,
hours of work, child labor, minimum age, medical examinations, night work, rest and holidays, equal pay, right to organize.
In coal mines.
Hours of work, women's employment, minimum age, safety, productivity, training.
They cover, too, the men who go down to the sea in ships. The seafarers' conventions.
Wages. Hours of work. Certification of able seamen. Accommodation of crews. Pensions. Indemnity in case of shipwreck. Protection of dockers against accidents.
There's some air, yeah. Are we? We did a boat.
111 conventions have been drafted to date, and to date, the total number of ratifications is 1,800. So, the World Labor Code is not merely a rhetorical headline. In almost every country in the world, and in almost every occupation, from farmhand to filing clerk, from deckhand to truck driver, it has transformed conditions of work. And its expansion and improvement remains a matter of basic concern to the ILO. But the tempests of motion, which have been so much a part of history during the last 40 years, have had their influence on the organization itself. Differences reveal themselves in different ways. Once again, Mr. David A. Morse.
When we began our work in 1919, our orientation was primarily European and a new world. Since the Second World War, we have become completely universal. We now have a membership of 80 member states.
It wasn't really, as we said, until 1945 that the building of social justice was set firmly on universal foundations. But the evolution of the ILO is one of quality as well as quantity.
Secondly, I think it should be pointed out that there is today a greatly increased concern with problems of underdeveloped countries in Asia, in Middle East, Africa, Latin America. This is a especially new and dynamic development since the end of the Second World War. And finally, there is an increasing emphasis on agricultural workers and non-manual workers or professional workers, an emphasis which was, for all practical purposes, non-existent at the time of the creation of the ILO in 1919. For example, agricultural workers are the vast majority of workers in underdeveloped countries, and non-manual workers are coming into prominence because of technological change in industry.
There's the mid-century spectrum. At one end, perhaps, an African tribesman, glimpsing a new future, a new civilization. At the other, a factory worker observing the installation of a dial and button-studded control panel and pondering the adjustments he himself must make in the age of automation and atomic energy. Currents of life, tempests of motion. The ILO responds to all this? Mr. Morse has described the organization today as an operational agency. While its traditional code-building work remains a basic occupation, more and more practical activities are taking their places in its program.
Our work is intimately linked with economic development and industrialization of underdeveloped countries. And this is a point the public, I hope, would come more and more to understand. Our work is practical. Our work is indispensably associated with economic development, with industrialization of underdeveloped countries. Our work in these areas falls broadly into categories such as manpower organization, vocational training, management development, cooperation in handicrafts, labor administration, social security, labor management relations, and so on. Now, each one of these projects has an immediate and practical effect. Since without such assistance and the building of institutions within underdeveloped countries to carry out these programs in the countries concerned, these countries would be unable to implement their economic development and other programs.
Spread out a map of the world. Focus on Bolivia, Ecuador, and Peru. ILO experts are there up to 15,000 feet above sea level on the Andean Plateau. They're helping 7 million once-forgotten people, the Indians, descendants of the Incas, to take their place in today. Two words are now back in the Andean Indian vocabulary: hope and possible. Now shift the focus eastward to the warm, damp lands of tropical Africa, and east again to the hot, dry lands of the Middle East, and east again to Asia, in the green islands of Indonesia. The ILO experts are in all these regions. Since 1950, 750 of them have worked in 50 countries. Mr. Morse describes some typical examples of the work.
We assisted in the creation of productivity centers in Egypt, Israel, Central America, and elsewhere, that distill and instill the latest productivity techniques at all levels of management and make a major contribution to the economic development programs and the building of the standards of living of these countries and regions. We are engaging in precisely the same kind of activity in India. In Burma, for example, while engaging in these activities, we are also engaging in other activities, as, for example, the building of a social security system for that country. We began by the drafting of basic legislation and the training of personnel for the administration of the social security system in Burma. Now there is a going social security system in the country.
In the final analysis, of course, productivity, social security, the whole complex that is a sound economy must rest on technical skill. And since 1953, the ILO has arranged for nearly 1,200 worker trainees to gain experience outside their own countries. There's nothing particularly novel in such an operation. The exchange student, the visiting professor, the interfusion of differing dexterities have no doubt been a feature of life since man first climbed down from the trees. But in these days of jet speed progress in technology and against the background of economic development, the method has taken on a new significance.
I work in a plant in Yugoslavia which prepares iron ore. 3 years ago, through the ILO training scheme, I went to Sweden and Finland to study methods of using low-grade ore. Since I came home, we've been able to introduce the technique in our plant, and we are now saving about 100 million dinars a year as a result. We are now hoping to go a stage further and introduce a process known as magnetic separation of ores, which will cut our costs of production even more. My trip, I think, was valuable.
If I may intrude just for a moment from the managerial point of view, the word skill these days has a pretty broad meaning. You can't confine it simply to the understanding of mechanical processes and techniques. There's a human element in it, too, in the field of labor-management relations. All over the world now, there's a keen appreciation of the role that both management and labor can play in laying sound foundations for economic and social change. If labor-management relations are poor, relationships throughout the whole structure of a community are likely to be poor, and productivity suffers as a result. I know that the ILO is giving these questions more and more attention, because I've been on more than one team of management and trade union leaders which the organization has sent out as part of an interchange scheme. Teams from the less developed countries visit the more advanced ones and vice versa to study what is being done to work out problems and difficulties in this field. This whole area of activity, when you consider the growing complexity of modern life and the speed of industrial progress, is absolutely essential. It's a reflection of a new fact, the fact that in the modern world, thinking has changed from the old patterns of crude exploitation to ones designed for mutual development, national and international.
In the last few minutes, we've scanned just one segment of a vast horizon. The record of ILO within that segment is a tribute to many people, workers, employers, and government officials, and to the five men who over 40 years have directed its work.
Albert Thomas. Of France.
Director General from 1919 to 1932.
Harold Butler of the United Kingdom.
From 1932 to 1938.
John G. Winant of the United States.
From 1938 to 1941.
Edward J. Phelan of Ireland.
From 1941 to 1948.
David A. Morse of the United States.
From 1948 to his term of office continues. Whatever special contributions each of the five may have made to the success of the organization, and whatever contribution the organization itself may have made to the cause of peace and social justice, all would agree with something Mr. Morse recently said.
No international agency can any longer do the job that has to be done in this world by itself, standing alone. The problems are too vast. The world now is too much alive to a need for a universal approach in order to influence people in learning habits of cooperation and peaceful settlement of disputes, whether these disputes be social or political. Secondly, there is a need to influence, through worldwide programs, the need for working out world problems, including the implementation of economic and social programs, so that they develop. So that these programs develop in freedom and with respect for the individual and for the dignity of the individual. Our work in the ILO, and our work as part of the family of the United Nations, and our work as an intergovernmental international organization will have been of no avail at all unless it results in strengthening the elements of freedom and the belief in the dignity of the individual. This we aim to do whether we are teaching tribesmen on the verge of a new civilization, or whether we are taking legislative action to eliminate forced labor and to promote freedom of association. Security without freedom, security without liberty, is fraudulent.
That 360-degree vision again. The immediacy of danger and conflict from time to time tends to obscure it. But it is one of the modern world's great realities. Expressions of it have multiplied many times since Mr. Appleton wrote his letter in 1916.
The time has arrived for the wide conception of human rights rather than the narrow one.
You find it in the founding concepts of all the instruments of the UN family. UNESCO, for example.
Since wars begin in the minds of men, it is in the minds of men that the defenses of peace must be constructed.
And the World Health Organization.
Health is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity.
And you find it in words like these.
The task of peacemaking in our times differs in important respects from the task in past centuries.
We are quoting from a speech given a few months ago by the Secretary General of the United Nations, Mr. Dag Hammarskjöld.
There is, first, the greater urgency of the need for peacemaking, and the fact that this urgency makes itself felt on a universal basis. This results from the rapidly increasing destructiveness of modern weapons and the growing interdependence of all parts of the world, an interdependence which makes every local war a potential world war. Nations have responded to this need by supplementing the instruments and procedures of classical diplomacy with the permanent machinery of international organization established by treaty. The League of Nations was the first expression of this response, and the United Nations is a second. The purpose of the United Nations, like the purpose of the League of Nations before it, is to add strength to the force of the common interest, as expressed in the Charter, and the consensus of member nations in the tasks of peacemaking and peacebuilding. Yet another difference between our times and past centuries arises from the form given to world organization and the simultaneous development of the modern media of communications, which, taken together, have made it possible for public opinion to become a major factor in international life.
So the segments merge into a total horizon. The grand design, the amalgam of ideal and action, stand like silhouettes against the still fragile but clearly visible light beyond that horizon. It could be a glorious dawn, because today,
in currents of life, in tempests of motion, in fervor of act, in the fire, in the storm,
we, the peoples of the United Nations, have resolved to combine our efforts to accomplish these aims.
In Tempests of Motion, a program for the 40th year of the International Labor Organization, was narrated by Joseph Cotton. It was written and produced by the International Staff of United Nations Radio.